I thought I'd just explain a little bit my background, just so that you know why I'm standing here talking about digital publishing. I have an honours degree in information management and publishing, and during that time, whilst I was at uni and not doing studying, I did some temping work for a company called Crone Publications Limited. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of them, but they're basically they were a business-to-business publishing company. And when I graduated, they gave me a permanent role. So that was roughly 20 years ago. And I worked in product development role for their very first company. It was their very first CD-ROM. Now, this doesn't might not sound very exciting to you, but back in the day, this was major. You know, it was like we were sending out books on floppy disks to our poor customers, who then had to, you know, go through about 8 or 9 uploads before they could start reading stuff. So putting it all on CD-ROM, and not only putting one book but many, was quite a thing. And it also introduced me, I think it was my first experience of not being able to do things because things are not enriched with metadata, or not being able to do things because they don't even have any metadata, or what's there is very basic. So then I moved on to content management and thesaurus management, which I'll talk about obviously in a minute. I was also the manager of the ChronoEye content platform for a number of years. And ChronoEye content platform is a product, so I'll go and give you a brief description of that. And finally, I spent the last 3 years at Chrono as a content architect, and I led a team of developers and content specialists working on thesaurus development, amongst many other things. I've talked about Chrono, but actually Chrono was part of Wolters Kluwer, who are a global publishing company. They're business-to-business reference publishing and one of the three largest reference publishing companies in the world. They publish mainly in business and finance and compliance, tax, audit and accounting, and healthcare. There were two publishing houses that formed Wolters Kluwer UK. One was Chrono Publications, which then became Chrono, and the other one was CCH Publishing Company, publishing houses. So that was WK in the UK. And then last year I left and I moved to Wiley, which you probably know as John Wiley & Sons. So they are a global academic publishing company, and they work on academic journal and scholarly research. So publishing principles are exactly the same, but very, very different ways of publishing, very different publishing areas. So I mentioned CD-ROM, and back in the day, Wolters Kluwer content online. Obviously, I don't know, again, if you guys probably know this, but CD-ROMs were regarded as a stepping stone from your print content to online. And as a reference publishing company, we knew that we had to get online. All publishers knew that they had to get online, and the biggest question was how. How do we do that? We've got years, we've got decades of legacy material, and it's all in book or some kind of print format. It is not built for online. So we had a step at it, and the first attempt was basically, it was a disaster. It was like, we served up a dog's dinner, and the focus group that looked at it just went, oh, this has just been built by a bunch of techies, isn't it? And I have to put my hand up because I was one of those. And yeah, what we did was we took separate sections and chapters from different loose leaf books and put them into this online structure using a, you know, software, and then tried to link between the two. And it was, you know, the different sections and the different chapters. And it was just, I mean, even when I was doing it, I was embarrassed. So that shows you kind of how bad it was. But what that did was made the company go away and have another think about it. It's like, well, if we're really serious about investing in this and getting into proper online publishing, we need to do it properly. So that's when ChronoEye was created. And don't ask me what the I stands for. Could be interactive, could be internet, could be anything. BBC did it, so did we. BBC lost their I, we didn't. But it was actually quite ahead of its time in publishing terms. And one of the reasons why it was using what we call smart content. So this has been touched on before a bit by Tom. Having different content types. So instead of building a publication that you then put online, what you build is different content types, and they're in content fragments. So you could have, you know, a content type is a feature, a content type is a Q&A, a content type is news, etc., etc. And this was done in XML. So most publishing at that time were using SGML, which is really good, but it's not fit for proper web publishing. And so that those content fragments, what we did was that did it that way so that they were independent of an architecture, and then you can do, impose the architecture, product architecture afterwards. So you have a CMS of content, and it's just agnostic of a product. That doesn't come into focus at that point. But to build it into a product with links and with references and with related areas, what you did need is a thesaurus, and that's where we built our very first company thesaurus for classification to apply proper metadata to the content. And that was, some of you probably know Alan Gilchrist, but he was what the consultant, one of the consultants we used to build that thesaurus, which I then took over as manager. And yeah, so it was unsiloed. What we were doing was unsiloing content, in contrast to books, journals, etc., which are very much siloed content. Just to put that in comparison, at this point in time, which was around about 2003, I think, our major competitor was going online with what they called Books on Screen. And when you clicked on to go to move to the next page, it emulated a page flipping over, which was lovely. You know, I'm not criticising them for doing that, even though I thought it was shite, but the reason for doing that was because we were very worried about how our customer base were actually going to react to start moving away from print and moving away from loose-leafs and all that. It's like we were having to kind of nurse them into going online. It seems pretty odd now, but back then it was a big deal. And with all, anything like that that's a big deal, you've got revenue attached and revenue risks. So, metadata and silos. Just wanted to quickly check through the pros and cons of unsiloed metadata. I know I'm probably preaching to the converted here in many cases. But one of the huge, I can't emphasise this, it's so huge, is reuse of content. As a publishing company, what we had, like, we published on employment law and health and safety across 8 different market areas. Employment law, it doesn't matter whether you're a care home manager, a headmaster, or what. Employment law affects you, and it doesn't change just because you're in a different market sector, and it doesn't change necessarily because you're in the public as opposed to private. If your content is siloed, if it's in different journals, etc., then what you're doing is you're rewriting the same piece of information over and over again, and you're paying for it over and over again. So what we wanted to do was just have core content that could then be used across multiple products, and the Chronoi model allowed us to do that. It also gave us flexibility for new content configuration and online product development, so that again we weren't confined by one particular product. Sad to say that once this product actually, you know, Chronoi took off and it was a success, what we did was we just made more and more Chronois instead of really exploring what else you could do. But the thinking behind this model was to be able to use this combination of unsiloed content, content fragments, and thesaurus and different types of metadata to be adventurous with content. The other thing it did, relating content that was previously buried, and I know you all know about this, it was like, again, you've got a legacy of content. You don't want to lose it. We didn't want to lose it. What a thesaurus does is it allows you to relate content which is not within that particular, I'm going to keep calling it a silo. So there's a phrase that I absolutely love, and I should cite the author, but I can't remember who said it, but it's called serendipitous discovery. And that's what, you know, this gives you, so that you can be looking at something, and in a strict taxonomic hierarchy, you can have 2 or 3 or 4, but they're not related to each other. You need that thesaurus structure. That was what that was all about. So, yeah, that's great pro about it is you can actually maximise your content assets as a publisher. So we could actually reuse content, which, if it had just been in book format, we might want to revise the book and reissue it annually. But this way, we can just, you know, we could do a lot more with it. And never forget, customers, it gives them a much, much better experience, and also offers new revenue streams with multiple options to grow should you have the imagination to take them. But there are cons, and the cons are not inconsiderable. Again, cost. This is new, so it's a new way of publishing. It's a new way of set of processes. A new way of creating CMSs that have to handle different markup languages and different ways of processing data and different ways of getting it out of the CMS and onto your front end. And that took effort. So, you know, back in the day, we devoted about, that was a year and a half, 2 year project before the new product ever saw the light of day. It's really unusual to get that kind of buy-in from a company. But they did it then, and it was worth it. And our old friend, resistance to change. People don't like new ways of working. So there is all really big hurdles that we had to try and figure out ways of getting through. But I think the attitude was, we believed in this, and it was so important for future development for the publishing company that this was really worthwhile. So this is just a brief illustration. This is Chrono Eye as it looks now, because I've left the company. I can't log in and show you lots of stuff. But this is just that bit here where the big circle is. So interviewing is a topic, and it's about interviewing people you're trying to recruit. It's got all kinds of things, different content down the side of it. So they're different content types. And what those resources are. That's picking up through the thesaurus classification. It's picking up different forms and letters which are related to this topic, because it's either they've been classified with a term which is interviewing, or it is related to interviewing. So without any front-end coding, without any links coding, which is always a really dangerous thing to get into, in my opinion, the content just appears. And if it gets changed, it gets changed. There's nobody has to do anything other than either change the content or change the thesaurus term. It's that simple. And this is a piece of daily news which is free to view, but the boxes underneath, again, they show illustrating the different content types, and they are populated through the thesaurus sort of classification that's been added there. As long as you get your thesaurus classification right, this works like a dream. And if you get it wrong, it just makes you look like a fool and don't know your own content. So that is something to be aware of. By contrast, and this is no criticism of the tax and accounting side of the business, they did not go down the same path. So all of this content originates from books. And if you go onto their free site, you can see that it's all, they just expand further and further and further down. And it's not a secret, this site has got a humongous amount of content, and it has literally hundreds of thousands of links which have to be maintained. And if a piece of content moves and nobody notices that, the link breaks. It's high maintenance, but I do believe they are working on changes for that. So a little bit about Wiley content online. As I said, mentioned, it's main journals and reference works, and they're all on the online Wiley. We deal with, I think, over 600 societies and publish reference journals for them. They are entitled to have a hub built, which is like a portal. So if they've got more than one journal, they can have a hub and have all their journals, which is in a branded hub. And one of the benefits of that is it actually includes the content enrichment. So it includes taxonomy, which at the moment is not, that's not a live feature on Wiley Online, but it will be very shortly, I believe. So the content is actually enriched with an existing taxonomy or custom-built taxonomy, which is my job. And this is just a quick illustration of what Hub looks like. This is the Physiological Society. The topics gives you this top level. So this is the top level of their taxonomy. And if you click on any of those, then on the left-hand side you will get a panel of filters, and that just shows you the different levels of that taxonomy. So very much contrast, Chrono taxonomy is underneath the hood and is not viewable by the user. Wiley, it's there, it's part of the search features. So just to contrast the different approaches to taxonomy work, which was, I have to say, a little, tiny bit of a culture shock to me. It was like, oh, you're doing that then and not this type thing. They all just clear. One, and I have to say, beautifully formed, thesaurus, which covered the 8 main market areas. I cried leaving that thesaurus behind, seriously. active use of related terms in the user interface, and it's also quite important embedded as part of the content pipeline. To the point that if you didn't classify your, I think it was the in-depth, or classify your content, then it went through a product build after it comes out of CMS, and that build would fail because it would go, well, you haven't classified it. It needs this metadata. It's integral to this content. Whereas Wiley, nearly 200 taxonomies. And I'm doing an audit of the domains that they cover because they've been collected over the last few years, either from external sources or they've been built, or the societies have themselves built them and given them to us. But I know there's a lot of subject overlap, so one of my jobs is to try and find out where the subject overlap is and try and make one master taxonomy for that area. And surprisingly, it's not yet part of the content pipeline in the same way as it was for Chroma. And finally, the taxonomies come in many and various forms. I mean, from a simple list, like seven terms to cover thousands of articles, which gobsmacks me, but to fully formed thesauri. We've got one taxonomy, which is a taxonomy, not a thesaurus, and it's got 2.5 million terms in it. And that covers species. So there's a lot of species out there in the world. Which brought me to, can you have too many taxonomies? If it's like, can you have too many handbags? The answer is no. But it was definitely, my feelings were, oh my God, 200 taxonomies, why do you need that many? The software that we've met, Tom, you mentioned Protégé. So the software that we used and the concept schemes that are in that software, can different projects or taxonomies be linked? So, what I was getting at here is if you've got multiple subject domains, then you're going to end up with multiple concept schemes. Different software treats concept schemes differently. You know, what we needed to do was look into, well, how those concept schemes treated by the software that I've used, because Wiley software treats concept schemes very differently from the software I used at Chroma, which treated concept schemes very differently from the software that we used prior to the one that we moved over to. And the reason why that is important, because it influences how you approach the formation of your thesaurus. If you're not careful, you find the software telling you how you're going to build your thesaurus. And personally, again, I'm not a fan of that. Understanding and expectations. I've mentioned internal resistance. New ways of working are often required and often resisted. If it's not broken, why fix it? I had this said to me once. It was a site. Basically, I've got all these indexes and I put them online. What's wrong with that? That will take another 20 minutes to tell you. Why can't somebody else do it? I'm too busy. You know, I agree with it in principle, but I haven't got the time and I'm far too important. Working with SMEs, which I didn't mean to link those two together, that also can have its challenges in that some people really get it, other people have a really mixed understanding of it, and you can go over it over and over again and they're not necessarily going to get it. They want to throw the kitchen sink in because they're subject matter experts and everything is important. And anxiety is produced that, well, you've left this one thing out, but if you only published one article on it in the last 10 years, then bugger it. You know, I'm not making a term for that particular thing because it's just what happens is it's just noise in your thesaurus. And business expectations and in views of enrichment can be a bit mixed as well. It's just a mechanical tool, isn't it? It means, you know, somebody in IT can just administer it. Well, yes and no. Clearly, it has to have that human element. What's my return on investment? This is a really difficult one to address because it's not necessarily a tangible thing, but it is a massive enhancement. It's the fairy dust on your content from a publishing point of view. And what do you mean it might never be finished? You know, that freaks people out. What, you haven't done it yet? Oh, no, I've still been doing it in 10 years. Oh, my God. What approach to take? Reactive or proactive? To quote Henry Ford, if I'd asked people what they wanted, they'd have said a faster horse. And that's very true. And it's not always easy for non-taxonomists to see the benefit of content classification. And also, pragmatically speaking, you have to accept that some people will never, ever get it. It's a shame if they're really high up in the business, I have to say, but, you know, that is an issue. There's also a great advantage, I think, in actually doing the work before anybody tells you you can do it, because then you can just go, ta-da, look what I've done, and they think you're great. Whereas if you're scrambling to catch up because somebody's read an article on how good taxonomies are, they are not quite so impressed. And look for opportunities to enrich your content and display the power of metadata, because I think that impresses way more than loads of presentations and discussions. Simply doing an illustration of a screenshot, as I've just done for you, I've seen more directors go, oh, right, I get it now. And especially when you follow it up with, well, you're going to be saving like £64,000 a year. So very quickly, future challenges. We want to embed the taxonomy application into the content pipeline. So it's not even thought about. It's just part of it. That's what you do. Promotion of understanding and enthusiasm for taxonomic classification within the business. Explore machine learning, which I thought about adding this into the talk, and then just thought we'd just spend the whole time covering that. But that is something that I'm working on at the moment, including text mining and entity extraction. And expansion of taxonomy features at the front end, because I don't want to hide it under a bushel. And possible development of ontologies. Again, you know, what we're doing at Wiley is about adding value to the content for the end user. If it doesn't add value, then don't do it. Don't waste your time doing it. Finally, a quote from Patrick Lamb, which really sums up, I think, my attitude towards being a taxonomist in a commercial world, is that most of your categorisation decisions are pragmatic ones, which is why so many information scientists need to forget a lot of their training if they are to design knowledge taxonomies that work in practice. And I love this quote. I think it's brilliant because I read it the other day and just thought, yeah, that's exactly how I've been living my taxonomy life for the last 20 years, I think. So there you go. Thank you for listening.
I really liked the idea that you brought up about enrichment, and it follows on from Kitana's earlier talk about enrich and then filter. So, you know, I think there's a theme emerging from that. And I was also interested by your reference to ontologies, because I think that came up in one of the other talks as well, the idea that actually maybe ontologies is the next way forward, which, you know, that we'll learn a little bit more about in the last talk.
Really interesting to see the end there, thing about sort of forgetting what you've learned in order to have a pragmatic approach. And something that I've sort of talked to people about was we refactored our event pages, and our user testing showed that marathons should no longer sit in the running because our users don't understand that to be the way that should be put together. Did you have any examples of things within the way the structure was put together that you've had to kind of forget what you know and kind of bring in a new thing?
There was one occasion where we had a website and it was built in a certain software, and they wanted to send a content type called the legislation tracker to this website, and it was supposed to be free content. And what the developers did, and I'm really, I don't know the ins and outs of how they did it, but what they did was they added thesaurus terms as just functional things, and that goes against the grain a lot with me, because it's controlled vocabulary, it's semantic metadata, it's not a trigger for something to happen artificially at another end, and I had to kind of swallow my pride over that one and live with it, and I was very grateful that a few years later they, pulled the plug on the website, so I could erase it from my thesaurus. But these things do happen. I argue against it, but it's that old adage, you pick your battles.
And you said you had 200 things, lovely, amazing, and then 2 million species in 2.5 million, yeah. How do you maintain all of that? Is it, do you mean 2.5 million labels?
Yes.
Or?
Right, and they are, and it's in the taxonomic structure, but it's actually, it belongs to society, I can't remember what the initial stand for, NCBI, but it's like, it's a national taxonomy course. Well, there's a couple of them. So biology, you've got that, linear taxonomy. So it contains, this is one authority file for
those species, taxon, if that makes sense. But there is another one, which is apparently even huger. So we don't do the maintenance. I've been writing rules to try and make the content tagging more sensible because of how many. They use synonyms a lot, and synonyms for the Latin term for a species can be something like perch or pilot. So that obviously gets mixed up in, but if you're piloting a plane, in some cases I've either deleted them or just said don't extract.
You hinted at a sort of tension between IT and content, like IT people think in data, whereas content people think about the needing pyramid.
Yeah.
That is something rather than just data. Has that been a problem, an issue? How you put together?
To be honest, I've regarded my role, and I think it still is. I've kind of yo-yoed between working in the content department or working in the IT department. Because basically my job has always been to be a bit of a bridge between those two. I'm not purely IT, and I'm not purely content either. You know, what we're trying to do is something very technical to enrich content. We need people with that content knowledge. And I need to know about content and how it's structured and how it's written, as well as how it's coded and how it is. So, yeah, it's a balancing act.
Thank you. That's a great note to finish on. Thank you very much.